This is Medieval Death Trip for Saturday, December 13th, 2025, episode 119, concerning Hinselmann the Kobold. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. During our look at the red cap of Celtic fairy folklore last episode, our sources offered up a number of similar or related figures from other cultures. Today, I wanted to focus in on one of them, one that's not just a type of creature, but an individual with a name, Hinselmann the Kobold of Hudumulen. If you play Dungeons & Dragons, you might think you've got a pretty good handle on what a kobold is. But unlike with the Red Cap, where D&D wasn't actually too far off, that game's kobolds have little in common with the Germanic spirits that lent them their name. And let's start with another little dip into RPG history, and hopefully a more accurate one than last time. So yes, first I have to thank listener Seb Wakely for leaving a comment identifying some earlier appearances of red caps in RPGs than the ones I identified last episode. Namely, their inclusion in RuneQuest in 1980, as well as an earlier write-up for their use in Advanced Dungeons & Dragons that appeared in White Dwarf magazine in 1983. Fortunately for today, I do feel on slightly firmer ground with kobolds, since I have my own physical copies of all the AD&D monster manuals I'll be referencing. D&D kobolds are best known as some of the first monsters you're likely to encounter on a level 1 adventure. Their consistent feature is that they are small and weak but aggressive, and really only dangerous in large groups or packs. And that probably informs their early appearance. In their first incarnations across basic and advanced D&D, they are described as dog-like. They have dog-like snouts and bark and yap. And that small but aggressive trait plays out in an angry chihuahua kind of vibe. They are also described as having scaly skin and are sometimes depicted with horns, but the dog theme runs strong. In the classic module, The Keep on the Borderlands from 1980, the kobolds in the Caves of Chaos are linked with the gnolls in the upper cave, with a pair of rumors the DM can give out about the caves, noting that, quote, there are hordes of tiny dogmen in the lower caves, or, quote, the big dogmen live very high in the caves. So, in those early days of D&D, kobolds seemed to be loosely grouped alongside the other goblinoid creatures, but starting in the year 2000 with 3rd edition D&D's Monster Manual, while kobolds still yap, they now do it in the Draconic language and are explicitly categorized as reptilian humanoids. And if you encounter kobolds in, say, Baldur's Gate 3, their dragonkin nature is strongly manifested in their design, and their dog-like qualities now reside more simply in their personalities. Neither vintage D&D kobolds nor modern D&D kobolds have much resemblance to the spirits of Germanic folklore. In some later sources, including the Brothers Grimm, kobolds are sometimes associated with spirits in mines that made knocking sounds in the tunnels. This is likely a case of confusion of the term kobold with the similar kobel, which was an attested term for mine spirits as far back as the 1500s. At any rate, this connection may be the most likely inspiration for little cave-dwelling monsters, because the other kobolds of folklore are very different. What they have in common with the mine spirits is a tendency to make knocking sounds in the walls. This makes them a form of poltergeist, which means noisy ghost. Indeed, Hinselmann, whom we are about to meet, has a lot in common with the disembodied voice that resided in the house of Sir Osborne of Bradwell, as reported by Ralph of Cogshall in our Green Children of Woolpit episode last year. In addition to knocking and making footsteps, kobolds might talk and sing and mimic and mock. But also, like the shoemaker's elves or Santa's elves, they could perform helpful tasks around the house, so long as they were properly appeased. So they are most properly categorized as Hausgeister, or house spirits, with many cousins in other European cultures. The origins of the word kobold are somewhat uncertain. Jakob Grimm tried to tie it to ancient Greek kovalos, meaning rogue or trickster, though this is almost certainly an erroneous etymology. It's much more likely that the word is of Germanic origin, with the cob element, meaning house or chamber, and the back half of the word is murkier. Our earliest actual textual evidence for the word kobold uses it specifically to refer to little carved figurines that presumably once represented household deities or guardian spirits. This usage is properly medieval and dates to the 13th century. At that time, they no longer appear to be sacred objects, that would be quite pagan, but rather they are a decorative carryover of an older pagan tradition, a bit like putting out garden gnomes today. We also see the word being used to describe a kind of puppet used in performance, so it's clearly linked to the category of toys and trifles. As such, it also gets used as a metaphorical description of a mute person, or as an insulting term for a foolish one, akin to blockhead. Your head's made of wood, like a doll or puppet, and or you have the big mouth and exaggerated features of a carved figure. Our best evidence points to the word then moving from this term for figurines or dolls onto a kind of house spirit in the early modern period. To what degree the figurines had been named after a spirit, we don't really know, so this could be the term coming full circle after a detour into being the name for a decoration, or it's possible the decorations got their own name distinct from the spirits that they represented and have passed that name on to the creature of folklore. What this means is that our medieval sources on kobolds aren't about the spirit or creature, at least not under that name, so I'll have to stretch the boundaries of our usual time period to get to today's text. It's not as big a stretch as having, say, a Romantic era ballad as the centerpiece of an episode, but there is a distinct kinship here with Leyden's Ballad of Lord Soulis. Our core source purportedly dates to the 1580s, which is only about a century beyond what is generally considered medieval, and it takes place in the castle estate of a German nobleman in Lower Saxony who probably isn't living that differently from his late medieval ancestors. However, our 16th century source comes to us through three later filters, the first from the early 18th century, the second Romantic, and the third Victorian. Our core source is allegedly the diaries of a pastor, Marquart Feldman, covering the years 1584 to 1588. An account said to be based on these diaries was published in a print book in 1704 with a long German title that translates into English as The Multi-Shaped Henselman, or The Circumlocutory and Remarkable Tale of a Spirit Who Appeared at the Hudemühlen House and Later at Estrup in the Lüneburg region in various forms. I have not been able to find any assessments of this book and whether or not we should just accept its claim that it's authentically presenting a text originating in the 1580s. As far as I've been able to ascertain, these diaries don't survive anywhere else other than in this 18th century book. In the absence of any other confirmation, I'd be rather skeptical myself that this wasn't all being invented in 1704, but our next authors in this chain of transmission did take it at face value. These would be the Brothers Grimm, who abridged the tale of Henselmann as they found it in that book to include it in their Deutsche Sagen, or German Legends, published in 1816. This took a 379-page account and condensed it down to about 25 pages, so a substantial trimming, but good for a podcast episode. The Grimm's text was then translated 34 years later by Thomas Keightley for inclusion in his highly influential 1850 book, The Fairy Mythology, which is the version we'll be hearing. Keightley has a connection to last episode as well. He was one of the uncredited contributors to Thomas Crofton Croker's Fairy Legends and Traditions of the South of Ireland, helping out a fellow Irishman, though he was one of the contributors who was publicly salty about not getting credited. Despite the importance of his book, The Fairy Mythology, we don't know a great deal about Keightley's life. He was born in Dublin in 1789, and as a young man had to give up an education in law due to poor health, and instead made money by writing history textbooks for some of the elite public schools of England, remembering that public school here means what Americans would call a private school. They're public in the sense of being open to anyone who can pay, regardless of where they're from, their religious backgrounds, or their family trade. Keightley claimed to be able to read over 20 different languages and dialects, but he was given to hyperbolic self-aggrandizement, so maybe take that with a grain of salt. For example, he claimed his history of Rome was the best written in any language, an opinion neither his peers nor posterity have shared. One of Keightley's genuine accomplishments is bringing to the early field of folklore studies a coherent comparative methodology, especially in how he identified connections between tales, but was very cautious about making claims of causality. Many of his contemporaries in the early 1800s were busy trying to trace out elaborate patterns of transmission to show how a story might move from Asia Minor to Ireland via trade routes or armies on the march, or they tried to claim underlying ancient racial linkages between, say, the Celtic and Teutonic peoples. Basically, the operating assumption in the field was that if two tales in two different cultures were similar, that showed that they had to have some kind of common origin that needed to be explained. Keightley, on the other hand, strongly countered that there's no reason why quite similar stories couldn't emerge independently in different places, and that similarity of tropes or plot beats is not enough evidence to claim common origin. He writes, quote, "As I advanced in my researches, I was every day more and more struck with the great similarity that pervades the legends of different countries. This is by many accounted for by supposing nations of common origin to have brought these legends from a common country, thus bestowing on the simplest incident an unknown antiquity. To me, this looks like applying a lever to raise a feather. We should not leave out of view the sameness that runs through the acts and thoughts of men, which wearies us in history, in fiction, and in common life. The truth I apprehend to be this. Some tales and legends are transmitted, others are, to speak geologically, independent formations. When, in a tale of some length, a number of circumstances are the same and follow in the same order, I would term it transmitted. Other circumstances may be referred to what we may call the poverty of human invention. Such are the swords of sharpness and the shoes of swiftness everywhere to be met with." End quote. Keightley also admits a third category of stories, which are those whose origins are simply mysterious, that share perhaps too much to believe they arose independently, but which also vary too much to seem to have a common origin. Analyzing Keightley's contribution, Richard M. Dorson concludes that, quote, "Keightley comes close here to the modern recognition of motif groups," end quote. So Keightley was perhaps a bit ahead of his time, but helped pave the way for a more anthropological study of folklore that could tear itself away from the nationalistic impulses that drove a lot of the early scholars in the field. And with that, let's get into our text. It begins with a brief introduction to kobolds by Keightley before he presents his translation of the Grimm's abridgment of the book based on Feldman's allegedly eyewitness account recorded in his diaries. Kobold is exactly the same being as the Danish Nis and Scottish Brownie and English Hobgoblin. He performs the very same services for the family to whom he attaches himself. When the kobold is about, coming into any place, he first makes trial of the disposition of the family in this way. He brings chips and sawdust into the house and throws dirt into the milk vessels. If the master of the house takes care that the chips are not scattered about, and that the dirt is left in the vessels and the milk drunk out of them, the kobold comes and stays in the house as long as there is one of the family alive. The change of servants does not affect the kobold, who still remains. The maid who is going away must recommend her successor to take care of him and treat him well. If she does not so, things go ill with her till she is also obliged to leave the place. The history of the celebrated Hinselmann will give most full and satisfactory information respecting the nature and properties of kobolds, for such he was, though he used constantly to deny it. His history was written at considerable length by a pious minister named Feldman. Monsieur Grimm gives us the following abridgment of it. Hinselmann. A wonderful house spirit haunted for a long time the old castle of Hudemühlen situated in the country of Lunaborg, not far from the Alla, and of which there is nothing remaining but the walls. It was in the year 1584 that he first notified his presence by knocking and making various noises. Soon after, he began to converse with the servants in the daylight. They were at first terrified at hearing a voice and seeing nothing, but by degrees they became accustomed to it and thought no more of it. At last he became quite courageous and began to speak to the master of the house himself, and used, in the middle of the day and in the evening, to carry on conversations of various kinds, and at mealtimes he discoursed with those who were present, whether strangers or belonging to the family. When all fear of him was gone, he became quite friendly and intimate. He sang, laughed, and went on with every kind of sport, so long as no one vexed him, and his voice was on these occasions soft and tender, like that of a boy or maiden. When he was asked whence he came, and what he had to do in that place, he said he was come from the Bohemian mountains, and that his companions were in the Bohemian forest, that they would not tolerate him, and that he was in consequence obliged to retire and take refuge with good people till his affairs should be in a better condition. He added that his name was Henselmann, but that he was also called Luring, and that he had a wife whose name was Hilla Bingles. When the time for it was come, he would let himself be seen in his real shape, but that at present it was not convenient for him to do so. In all other respects he was, he said, as good and honest a fellow as needs be. The master of the house, when he saw that the spirit attached himself more and more to him, began to get frightened, and knew not how he should get rid of him. By the advice of his friends, he determined at last to leave his castle for some time and set out for Hanover. On the road they observed a white feather that flew beside the carriage, but no one knew what it signified. When he arrived at Hanover, he missed a valuable gold chain that he wore about his neck, and his suspicions fell upon the servants of the house. But the innkeeper took the part of his servants and demanded satisfaction for the discreditable charge. The nobleman, who could prove nothing against them, sat in his chamber in bad spirits, thinking how he should manage to get himself out of this unpleasant affair, when, all of a sudden, he heard Henselmann's voice beside him, saying, "Why are you so sad? If there is anything gone wrong with you, tell it to me, and I shall perhaps know how to assist you. If I were to make a guess, I should say that you are fretting on account of a chain you have lost." "What are you doing here?" replied the terrified nobleman. "Why have you followed me? Do you know anything about the chain?" "Yes, indeed," said Henselmann. "I have followed you, and I kept you company on the road, and was always present. Did you not see me? Why, I was the white feather that flew beside the carriage. And now I'll tell you where the chain is. Search under the pillow of your bed, and there you'll find it." The chain was found where he said, but the mind of the nobleman became still more uneasy, and he asked him in an angry tone why he had brought him into a quarrel with the landlord on account of the chain, since he was the cause of his leaving his own house. Henselmann replied, "Why do you retire from me? I can easily follow you anywhere and be where you are. It is much better for you to return to your own estate and not be quitting it on my account. You see well that if I wished it, I could take away all you have, but I am not inclined to do so." The nobleman thought some time on it, and at last came to the resolution of returning home and trusting in God not to retreat a step from the spirit. At home in Hudemühlen, Henselmann now showed himself extremely obliging and active and industrious at every kind of work. He used to toil every night in the kitchen, and if the cook, in the evening after supper, left the plates and dishes lying in a heap without being washed, next morning they were all nice and clean, shining like looking glasses, and put up in proper order. She therefore might depend upon him and go to bed in the evening after supper without giving herself any concern about them. In like manner, nothing was ever lost in the kitchen. If anything was astray, Henselmann knew exactly where to find it, in whatever corner it was hid, and gave it into the hands of the owner. If strangers were expected, the spirit let himself be heard in a particular manner, and his labors were continued the whole night long. He scoured the pots and kettles, washed the dishes, cleaned the pails and tubs. The cook was grateful to him for all this, and not only did what he desired, but cheerfully got ready his sweet milk for his breakfast. He also took the charge of superintending the other men and maids. He noticed how they got through their business, and when they were at work, he encouraged them with good words to be industrious. But if anyone was inattentive to what he said, he caught up a stick and communicated his instructions by laying on heartily with it. He frequently warned the maids of their mistress's displeasure and reminded them of some piece of work which they should set about doing. He was equally busy in the stable. He attended to the horses and curried them carefully so that they were as smooth in their coats as an eel. They also throve and improved so much in next to no time that everybody wondered at it. His chamber was in the upper story on the right-hand side, and his furniture consisted of only three articles. In primis, of a settle or armchair, which he plaited very neatly for himself of straw of different colors, full of handsome figures and crosses, which no one looked upon without admiration. Secondly, of a little round table, which was on his repeated entreaties made and put there. Thirdly, of a bed and bedstead, which he had also expressed a wish for. There never was any trace found as if a man had lain in it. There could only be perceived a very small depression, as if a cat had been there. The servants, especially the cook, were obliged every day to prepare a dish full of sweet milk with crumbs of wheaten bread and place it upon his little table, and it was soon after eaten up clean. He sometimes used to come to the table of the master of the house, and they were obliged to put a chair and plate for him at a particular place. Whoever was helping put his food on his plate, and if that was forgotten, he fell into a great passion. What was put on his plate vanished, and a glass full of wine was taken away for some time, and was then set again in its place empty. But the food was afterwards found lying under the benches, or in a corner of the room. In the society of young people, Hinselmann was extremely cheerful. He sang and made verses. One of his most usual ones was, "If thou here wilt let me stay, good luck shalt thou have alway. But if hence thou wilt me chase, luck will ne'er come near the place." He used also to repeat the songs and sayings of other people by way of amusement or to attract their attention. The minister Feldman was once invited to Hudemühlen, and when he came to the door, he heard someone above in the hall singing, shouting, and making every sort of noise, which made him think that some strangers had come the evening before and were lodged above and making themselves merry. He therefore said to the steward, who was standing in the court after having cut up some wood, "John, what guests have you above there?" The steward answered, "We have no strangers. It is only our Hinselmann who is amusing himself. There is not a living soul else in the hall." When the minister went up into the hall, Hinselmann sang out to him, my thumb, and my elbow are two." The minister wondered at this unusual kind of song, and he said to Hinselmann, "What sort of music is that you come to meet me with?" "Why," replied Hinselmann, "it was from yourself I learned the song, for you have often sung it, and it is only a few days since I heard it from you, when you were in a certain place at a christening." Hinselmann was fond of playing tricks, but he never hurt anyone by them. He used to set servants and workmen by the ears as they sat drinking in the evening, and took great delight then in looking at the sport. When any one of them was well warmed with liquor, and let anything fall under the table and stooped to take it up, Hinselmann would give him a good box on the ear from behind, and at the same time pinch his neighbor's leg. When the two attacked each other, first with words and then with blows, the rest joined in the scuffle, and they dealt about their blows and were repaid in kind, and next morning black eyes and swelled faces bore testimony of the fray. But Hinselmann's very heart was delighted at it, and he used afterwards to tell how it was that he began it on purpose to set them fighting. He, however, always took care so to order matters that no one should run any risk of his life. There came one time to Hudemühlen a nobleman who undertook to banish Hinselmann. Accordingly, when he remarked that he was in a certain room, of which all the doors and windows were shut fast, he had this chamber and the whole house also beset with armed men, and went himself with his drawn sword into the room, accompanied by some others. They, however, saw nothing, so they began to cut and thrust left and right in all directions, thinking that if Hinselmann had a body, some blow or other must certainly reach him and kill him. Still, they could not perceive that their hangers met anything but mere air. When they thought they must have accomplished their task and were going out of the room tired with their long fencing, just as they opened the door, they saw a figure like that of a marten and heard these words, "Ha ha! How well you caught me!" But Hinselmann afterwards expressed himself very bitterly for this insult and declared that he would have easily had an opportunity of revenging himself were it not that he wished to spare the two ladies of the house any uneasiness. When this same nobleman, not long after, went into an empty room in the house, he saw a large snake lying coiled up on an unoccupied bed. It instantly vanished, and he heard the words of the spirit, "You were near catching me." Another nobleman had heard a great deal about Henselmann, and he was curious to get some personal knowledge of him. He came accordingly to Hudemühlen, and his wish was not long ungratified, for the spirit let himself be heard from a corner of the room where there was a large cupboard, in which were standing some empty wine jugs with long necks. As the voice was soft and delicate, and somewhat hoarse, as if it came out of a hollow vessel, the nobleman thought it likely that he was sitting in one of these jugs. So he got up and ran and caught them up and went to stop them, thinking in this way to catch the spirit. While he was thus engaged, Henselmann began to laugh aloud and cried out, "If I had not heard long ago from other people that you were a fool, I might now have known it of myself, since you thought I was sitting in an empty jug and went to cover it up with your hand, as if you had me caught. I don't think you worth the trouble, or I would have given you long since such a lesson that you should remember me long enough. But before long, you will get a slight ducking." He then became silent, and did not let himself be heard any more so long as the nobleman stayed. Whether he fell into the water, as Henselmann threatened him, is not said, but it is probable he did. There came, too, an exorcist to banish him. When he began his conjuration with his magic words, Henselmann was at first quite quiet, and did not let himself be heard at all. But when he was going to read the most powerful sentences against him, he snatched the book out of his hand, tore it to pieces so that the leaves flew about the room, caught hold of the exorcist himself, and squeezed and scratched him till he ran away frightened out of his wits. He complained greatly of this treatment and said, "I am a Christian, like any other man, and I hope to be saved." When he was asked if he knew the kobolds and knocking spirits, he answered, "What have these to do with me? They are the devil's specters, and I do not belong to them. No one has any evil, but rather good, to expect from me. Let me alone, and you will have luck in everything. The cattle will thrive, your substance will increase, and everything will go on well." Profligacy and vice were quite displeasing to him. He used frequently to scold severely one of the family for his stinginess, and told the rest that he could not endure him on account of it. Another he upbraided with his pride, which he said he hated from his heart. When someone once said to him that if he would be a good Christian, he should call upon God and say Christian prayers, he began the Lord's Prayer, and went through it till he came to the last petition, when he murmured, "Deliver us from the evil one," quite low. He also repeated the Creed, but in a broken and stammering manner, for when he came to the words, "I believe in the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and life everlasting," he pronounced them in so hoarse and indistinct a voice that no one could rightly hear and understand him. The minister of Eikeloka, Mr. Feldmann, said that his father was invited to dinner at Hudemühlen at Whitsuntide, where he heard Henselmann go through the whole of the beautiful hymn, "Nun bitten wir den Heiligen Geist," in a very high but not unpleasant voice, like that of a girl or a young boy. Nay, he sang not merely this, but several other spiritual songs also when requested, especially by those whom he regarded as his friends and with whom he was on terms of intimacy. On the other hand, he was extremely angry when he was not treated with respect and as a Christian. A nobleman of the family of Mandelsloh once came to Hudemühlen. This nobleman was highly respected for his learning. He was a canon of the Cathedral of Verden, and had been ambassador to the Elector of Brandenburg and the King of Denmark. When he heard of the house spirit, and that he expected to be treated as a Christian, he said he could not believe that this was all right with him. He was far more inclined to regard him as the enemy and the devil, for that God had never made men of that kind and form, that angels praised God their Lord and guarded and protected men, with which the knocking and pounding and strange proceedings of the house spirit did not accord. Henselmann, who had not let himself be heard since his arrival, now made a noise and cried out, "What say you, Barthold?" That was the nobleman's name. "Am I the enemy? I advise you not to say too much, or I will show you another trick and teach you to deliver a better judgment of me another time." The nobleman was frightened when he heard a voice without seeing anyone, broke off the discourse, and would hear nothing more of him, but left him in possession of his dignity. Another time, a noble came there who, when he saw a chair and plate laid for Henselman at dinner, refused to pledge him. At this, the spirit was offended, and he said, "I am as honest and good a fellow as he is. Why then does he not drink to me?" To this, the nobleman replied, "Depart hence, and go drink with thy infernal companions. Thou hast nothing to do here." When Henselman heard that, he became so highly exasperated that he seized him by the strap with which, according to the custom of those days, his cloak was fastened under his chin, dragged him to the ground, and choked and pressed him in such a manner that all that were present were in pain lest he should kill him. And the gentleman did not come to himself for some hours after the spirit had left him. Another time, an esteemed friend of the master of Hudemühlen was traveling that way, but he hesitated to come in on account of the house spirit, of whose mischievous turn he had heard a great deal, and sent his servant to inform the family that he could not call upon them. The master of the house sent out and pressed him very much to come in and dine there, but the stranger politely excused himself by saying that it was not in his power to stop. He, however, added that he was too much terrified at the idea of sitting at the same table, eating and drinking with a devil. Henselman, it appears, was present at this conversation out in the road, for when the stranger had thus refused, they heard these words, "Wait, my good fellow, you shall be well paid for this talk." Accordingly, when the traveler went on and came to the bridge over the Maisa, the horses took fright, entangled themselves in the harness, and horses, carriage and all, were within an ace of tumbling down into the water. When everything had been set to rights, and the carriage had got on about a gunshot, it was turned over in the sand on level ground, without, however, those who were in it receiving any further injury. Henselman was fond of society, but the society he chiefly delighted in was that of females, and he was to them very friendly and affable. There were two young ladies at Hudemühlen, named Anne and Catherine, to whom he was particularly attached. He used to make his complaint to them whenever he was angry at anything, and held, besides, conversations of every kind with them. Whenever they traveled, he would not quit them, but accompanied them everywhere in the shape of a white feather. When they went to sleep at night, he lay beneath, at their feet, outside the clothes, and in the morning there was a little hole to be seen, as if a little dog had lain there. Neither of these ladies ever married, for Henselman frightened away their wooers. Matters had frequently gone so far as the engagement, but the spirit always contrived to have it broken off. One lover he would make all bewildered and confused when he was about to address the lady, so that he did not know what he should say. In another, he would excite such fear as to make him quiver and tremble. But his usual way was to make a writing appear before their eyes on the opposite white wall, with these words in golden letters, "Take Maid Anne and leave me Maid Catherine." But if anyone came to court Lady Anne, the golden writing changed all at once and became, "Take Maid Catherine and leave me Maid Anne." If anyone did not change his course for this, but persisted in his purpose and happened to spend the night in the house, he terrified and tormented him so in the dark with knocking and flinging and pounding that he laid aside all wedding thoughts and was right glad to get away with a whole skin. Some, when they were on their way back, he tumbled, themselves and their horses, over and over that they thought their necks and legs would be broken and yet knew not how it had happened to them. In consequence of this, the two ladies remained unmarried. They arrived to a great age and died within a week of each other. One of these ladies once sent a servant from Hudemühlen to Rethem to buy different articles. While he was away, Henselman began suddenly to clapper in the lady's chamber like a stork, and then said, "Maid Anne, you must go look for your things today in the mill stream." She did not know what this meant, but the servant soon came in and related that as he was on his way home, he had seen a stork sitting at no great distance from him, which he shot at, and it seemed to him as if he had hit it, but that the stork had remained sitting, and at last began to clap its wings aloud, and then flew away. It was now plain that Henselman knew this, and his prophecy also soon came to pass, for the servant, who was a little intoxicated, wanted to wash his horse, who was covered with sweat and dirt, and he rode him into the millstream in front of the castle. but owing to his drunkenness, he missed the right place and got into a deep hole, where, not being able to keep his seat on the horse, he fell off and was drowned. He had not delivered the things he had brought with him, so they and the body together were fished up out of the stream. Henselman also informed and warned others of the future. There came to Hudemühlen a colonel, who was greatly esteemed by Christian III, King of Denmark, and who had done good service in the wars with the town of Lübeck. He was a good shot and passionately fond of the chase, and used to spend many hours in the neighboring woods after the harts and wild sows. As he was getting ready one day to go to the chase as usual, Henselman came and said, "Thomas," that was his name, "I warn you to be cautious how you shoot, or you will before long meet with a mishap." The colonel took no notice of this and thought it meant nothing. But a few days after, as he was firing at a roe, his gun burst and took the thumb off his left hand. When this occurred, Henselman was instantly by his side and said, "See, now you have got what I warned you of. If you had refrained from shooting this time, this mischance would not have befallen you." Another time, a certain Lord Falkenberg, who was a soldier, was on a visit to Hudemühlen. He was a lively, jolly man, and he began to play tricks on Henselman, and to mock and jeer him. Henselman would not long put up with this, and he began to exhibit signs of great dissatisfaction. At last he said, "Falkenberg, you are making very merry now at my expense, but wait till you come to Magdeburg, and there your cap will be burst in such a way that you will forget your jibes and your jeers." The nobleman was awed. He was persuaded that these words contained a hidden sense. He broke off the conversation with Henselman, and shortly after departed. Not long after, the siege of Magdeburg, under the Elector Maurice, commenced, at which this Lord Falkenberg was present under a German prince of high rank. The besieged made a gallant resistance, and night and day kept up a firing of double arquebuses and other kinds of artillery, and it happened that one day Falkenberg's chin was shot away by a ball from a falconet, and 3 days after he died of the wound in great agony. Anyone whom the spirit could not endure, he used to plague or punish for his vices. He accused the secretary at Hudemühlen of too much pride, took a great dislike to him on account of it, and night and day gave him every kind of annoyance. He once related with great glee how he had given the haughty secretary a sound box on the ear. When the secretary was asked about it, and whether the spirit had been with him, he replied, "Aye, indeed, he has been with me but too often. This very night he tormented me in such a manner that I could not stand before him." He had a love affair with the chambermaid, and one night, as he was in high and confidential discourse with her, and they were sitting together in great joy, thinking that no one could see them but the four walls, the crafty spirit came and drove them asunder, and roughly tumbled the poor secretary out at the door, and then took up a broomstick and laid on him with it, and then he made over head and neck for his chamber and forgot his love altogether. Henselman is said to have made some verses on the unfortunate lover, and to have often sung them for his amusement, and repeated them to travelers, laughing heartily at them. One time, someone at Hudemühlen was suddenly taken in the evening with a violent fit of the colic, and a maid was dispatched to the cellar to fetch some wine, in which the patient was to take his medicine. As the maid was sitting before the cask, and was just going to draw the wine, Henselman was by her side, and said, "You will be pleased to recollect that, a few days ago, you scolded me and abused me. By way of punishment for it, you shall spend this night sitting in the cellar. As to the sick person, he is in no danger whatever. His pain will all be gone in half an hour, and the wine would rather injure him. So just stay sitting here till the cellar door is opened." The patient waited a long time, but no wine came. Another maid was sent down, and she found the cellar door well secured on the outside with a good padlock, and the maid sitting within, who told her that Henselman had fastened her up in that way. They wanted to open the cellar and let the maid out, but they could not find a key for the lock, though they searched with the greatest industry. Next morning, the cellar was open, and the lock and key lying before the door. Just as the spirit said, all his pain left the sick man in the course of half an hour. Henselman had never shown himself to the master of the house at Hudemühlen, and whenever he begged of him that if he was shaped like a man, he would let himself be seen by him, he answered that the time was not yet come, that he should wait till it was agreeable to him. One night, as the master was lying awake in bed, he heard a rushing noise on one side of the chamber, and he conjectured that the spirit must be there. So he said, "Hinselmann, if you are there, answer me." "It is I," replied he. "What do you want?" As the room was quite light with the moonshine, it seemed to the master as if there was the shadow of a form like that of a child, perceptible in the place from which the sound proceeded. As he observed that the spirit was in a very friendly humor, he entered into conversation with him and said, "Let me, for this once, see and feel you." But Hinselmann would not. "Will you reach me your hand at least, that I may know whether you are flesh and bone like a man?" "No," said Hinselmann, "I won't trust you. You are a knave. You might catch hold of me and not let me go anymore." After a long demur, however, and after he had promised, on his faith and honor, not to hold him, but to let him go again immediately, he said, "See, there is my hand." And as the master caught at it, it seemed to him as if he felt the fingers of the hand of a little child. But the spirit drew it back quickly. The master further desired that he would let him feel his face, to which he at last consented. And when he touched it, it seemed to him as if he had touched teeth or a fleshless skeleton, and the face drew back instantaneously, so that he could not ascertain its exact shape. He only noticed that it, like the hand, was cold and devoid of vital heat. The cook, who was on terms of great intimacy with him, thought that she might venture to make a request of him, though another might not, and as she felt a strong desire to see Hinselmann bodily, whom she heard talking every day, and whom she supplied with meat and drink, she prayed him earnestly to grant her that favor. But he would not, and said that this was not the right time, but that after some time he would let himself be seen by any person. This refusal only stimulated her desire, and she pressed him more and more not to deny her request. He said she would repent of her curiosity if she would not give up her desire. And when all his representations were to no purpose, and she would not give over, he at last said to her, "Come tomorrow morning before sunrise into the cellar, and carry in each hand a pail full of water, and your request shall be complied with." The maid inquired what the water was for. "That you will learn," answered he. "Without it, the sight of me might be injurious to you." Next morning, the cook was ready at the peep of dawn, took in each hand a pail of water, and went down to the cellar. She looked about her without seeing anything, but as she cast her eyes on the ground, she perceived a tray, on which was lying a naked child, apparently 3 years old, and two knives sticking crossways in his heart, and his whole body streaming with blood. The maid was terrified at this sight to such a degree that she lost her senses and fell in a swoon on the ground. The spirit immediately took the water that she had brought with her and poured it all over her head, by which means she came to herself again. She looked about for the tray, but all had vanished, and she only heard the voice of Hinselmann, who said, "You see now how needful the water was. If it had not been at hand, you had died here in the cellar. I hope your burning desire to see me is now pretty well cooled." He often afterwards eluded the cook with this trick, and told it to strangers with great glee and laughter. He frequently showed himself to innocent children when at play. The minister Feldman recollected well that when he was about 14 or 15 years old and was not thinking particularly about him, he saw the spirit in the form of a little boy going up the stairs very swiftly. When children were collected about Hudemühlen House and were playing with one another, he used to get among them and play with them in the shape of a pretty little child, so that all the other children saw him plainly, and when they went home, told their parents how, while they were engaged in play, a strange child came to them and amused himself with them. This was confirmed by a maid, who went one time into a room in which four or six children were playing together, and among them she saw a strange little boy of a beautiful countenance, with curled yellow hair hanging down his shoulders, and dressed in a red silk coat. And while she wanted to observe him more closely, he got out of the party and disappeared. Hinselmann let himself be seen also by a fool named Klaus, who was kept there, and used to pursue every sort of diversion with him. When the fool could not anywhere be found, and they asked him afterwards where he had been so long, he used to reply, I was with the little wee man, and I was playing with him. If he was further asked how big the little man was, he held his hand at the height about that of a child of 4 years. When the time came that the house spirit was about to depart, he went to the master of the house and said to him, "See, I will make you a present. Take care of it, and let it remind you of me." He then handed him a little cross. It is doubtful from the author's words whether of silk or strings, very prettily plated. It was the length of a finger, was hollow within, and jingled when it was shaken. Secondly, a straw hat, which he had made himself, and in which might be seen forms and figures very ingeniously made in the variously colored straw. Thirdly, a leathern glove set with pearls, which formed wonderful figures. He then subjoined this prophecy: "So long as these things remain unseparated in good preservation in your family, so long will your entire race flourish, and their good fortune continually increase. But if these presents are divided, lost, or wasted, your race will decrease and sink." And when he perceived that the master appeared to set no particular value on the present, he continued, "I fear that you do not much esteem these things, and will let them go out of your hands. I therefore counsel you to give them in charge to your sisters Anne and Catherine, who will take better care of them." He accordingly gave the gifts to his sisters, who took them and kept them carefully, and never showed them to any but the most particular friends. After their death, they reverted to their brother, who took them to himself, and with him they remained so long as he lived. He showed them to the minister Feldman, at his earnest request, during a confidential conversation. When he died, they came to his only daughter Adelaide, who was married to L. von H., along with the rest of his inheritance, and they remained for some time in her possession. The son of the minister Feldman made several inquiries about what had afterwards become of the house spirit's presence, and he learned that the straw hat was given to the Emperor Ferdinand II, who regarded it as something wonderful. The leathern glove was still, in his time, in the possession of a nobleman. It was short and just exactly reached above the hand, and there was a snail worked with pearls on the part that came above the hand. What became of the little cross was never known. The spirit departed of his own accord after he had stayed 4 years, from 1584 to 1588, at Hudemühlen. He said, before he went away, that he would return once more when the family would be declined, and that it would then flourish anew and increase in consequence. So, there you have the tale of Hinselmann, the kobold of Hudemühlen. Sadly, the castle fell into ruination in the 1600s and is no longer standing, so it's unclear where Hinselmann might ever return to in order to reverse the family's decline. Keitley adds a footnote onto the end of this story, quote, "The feats of house spirits, it is plain, may in general be ascribed to ventriloquism and to contrivances of servants and others," end quote. This is an interesting conclusion, given that later in life we have evidence that Keitley was interested in spiritualism. Among the scant sources of more personal biographical information on Keitley that we have are the writings of the members of the Rossetti family, whose children included poet and painter Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the writer and critic William Michael Rossetti, and poet Christina Rossetti, who added to the canon of fairy literature with her poem Goblin Market. Keitley was a friend of the family. William Michael Rossetti writes of having attended a séance at the home Keitley shared with his sister, at which the spirit of William's dead wife manifested. One has to wonder whether Keitley was as skeptical of the knockings and voices that often featured in a 19th-century spiritualist séance as he was of the goings-on at Hudemühlen. But thinking of spiritualism and the Society for Psychical Research that emerged at this time and would go on into the 20th century to famously investigate modern cases of very similar phenomena to Hinselmann, two connections stand out. The first is to the modern conception of the poltergeist in paranormal investigation culture. It has narrowed from its Germanic folkloric roots and now typically has as its central feature an association with a living person, usually an adolescent, and the moving and throwing of objects, along with noise making. Many link it to a psychic phenomenon tied to the adolescent, rather than a ghostly haunting per se, but many famous cases have a named spirit at the center, like the Enfield poltergeist that was loosely represented in The Conjuring 2, or the case of Jeff the Talking Mongoose on the Isle of Man. And these cases share striking commonalities with the early modern kobolds and medieval disembodied voices. A paranormal believer likely looks at that and sees a continuity that proves that spirits have lived alongside humanity since the dawn of time and aren't just folklore. A skeptic or materialist sees evidence of the continuity of how the human brain can keep making similar errors of overly enthusiastic pattern recognition. But it is interesting to note that while what ghosts look like does seem to track with culture and change at distinct moments, not unlike representations of UFOs and aliens, what ghosts sound like does seem to have an eerie consistency across time and culture. Fairies, too, change appearance with culture, and that touches our second point of connection to 19th and early 20th century spiritualism, which is one of its famous adherents, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who got duped by the photographs of the Cottingley Fairies of 1917. While the two girls who took those photos, Elsie Wright and Frances Griffiths, confessed to modeling their cutout fairies on images of fairies from children's books that already existed, they added the butterfly wings and set the scale of their fairies at under a foot tall. Given how much their images circulated in the 1920s, one wonders how much credit they should get for locking in our modern Tinkerbell image of fairies. Interestingly, the 1704 book that first preserves in print Henselmann's story features a number of illustrations, including some of the kobold himself. We see the scene of the cook beholding the image of a murdered child, and we see children playing with an extra playmate, but the most striking image is a plate showing Henselmann helping clean up the kitchen, where he is depicted as a small nude child with little white bird wings, basically a cherub. This is an interesting choice, since no one in the story ever sees or describes him this way, unless it's somewhere in that 300-odd-page-long version from 1704, which, to my knowledge, has never been translated into English, and so I wasn't able to skim through it to see. But it does seem unlikely to me that the Grimms would have omitted that detail. Other than manifesting as a feather, there's no sense of wings, though wings are a traditional feature of angels and some devils in artistic representation. I also just find it interesting how if you write out small human figure with wings, it's very easy to envision fairy along modern lines. But when you actually see this engraving, fairy is not at all what it conjures up. Which again, I think reveals more about how our conception of what fairy means has changed over the centuries. And speaking of Henselmann's various shapes, we can very lightly validate Dungeons & Dragons with the fact that he is compared to a little dog, especially in the impression he leaves in the spot that he lies in at the foot of the bed. Jakob Grimm also linked him to other sprites with hens elements in their names that all connect to cats or having the shapes of cats. So at the very least, we can say that there is some association with small furry critters in the kobold's DNA. Another intriguing figure in this tale is the exorcist, which is how Keitley translates the German word Teufelsbanner, or literally devil's banner, one who banishes evil spirits. You might have noticed that he doesn't appear to be praying or reciting the rite of exorcism. He is instead saying magic words, Zauberworte. The Teufelsbanner could be a priest or cleric, as in the career of Johann Josef Gassner, an Austrian priest of the mid-1700s who not only cast out devils but worked miracle cures. Gassner's methods were called out by Franz Anton Mesmer as operating not by spiritual power, but through Gassner's own powers of animal magnetism, or what was later called mesmerism and is now known as hypnosis. And this points to the more general reputation of the Teufelsbanner as being in a category of folk magicians shared by fortune tellers and faith healers who could just as easily find themselves accused of witchcraft as praised as wonder workers in the early modern period. And it certainly sounds like our exorcist here falls more into the group of local cunning folk who has shown up to smudge the house with sage and read a few incantations from a book, than that of a priest attempting to perform a religious rite. That said, Feldman's representation of Henselmann, as filtered through the Grimms, does have much in common with our medieval attempts to define fairy-like beings, in that Henselmann, like Meridiana in Walter Mapp's account of Gerbert d'Auriac, is quite insistent that he is not demonic, and seems, like St. Antony's satyr we heard about last episode, to profess Christianity. And yet, there's this ambiguity surrounding that alleged faith, where he falters a bit in voicing the Lord's Prayer and the Apostles' Creed. He's not infernal, but he doesn't seem safely angelic either. From the perspective of modern paranormal categories, we'd probably feel pretty safe just classifying him as the ghost of a deceased person, probably a child, though his claims to have a wife, Hilla Bingles, don't seem to line up with that very well, unless we take that as just more childish fibbing. Like other fairies, he seems to run at emotional extremes, flipping from friendliness to malice quite suddenly, though never arbitrarily. He responds to provocations. His pranks are said never to be too harmful, but he does wreck a carriage and throw people from horses and cause household brawls. And also, though presumably these fall into the category of prophecy and not curse, the blowing off of one visitor's thumb and another's chin still seem to have the fingerprints of Henselmann on them to some degree. That unsettling duality of friendly and horrible is perhaps best captured in the wonderfully eerie scene of the Lord of Hudumulen finally getting his chance to feel Henselmann, who reveals a soft, childlike, corpse-cold hand and a face that feels like bone. He shows the cook the image of a murdered child, and in some other legends, kobolds are explicitly linked to the spirits of dead children, but one certainly gets the impression that whatever Henselmann's true nature is, it isn't that, and whatever it is, it's something that human beings aren't prepared to see and accept. Our mystery word this episode is kalama, K-A-L-A-M, A with a circumflex, R. This word appears in Middle High German, though it is a borrowing from Latin. Its medieval Latin counterpart is calamarium, spelled with a C. I'll give you a second to guess what you think this word means. If you think it has to do with squid, you are partially correct. In fact, squid are calamari because they resemble the original calamus, which is a writing pen made from a reed, which looks like the chitinous structure inside the squid that supports its shape, also called the gladius. This does seem to be the main point of comparison, this internal shell of the squid, but the fact that the squid also produces ink no doubt helps reinforce the association with a writing pen. You get the A-R-I in there by turning calamus, writing pen, into calamarius, pertaining to a writing pen. And then medieval Latin takes calamarium to mean specifically a tube or container for one's writing tools. And then medieval German dropped the ending and added it to the vernacular with Germanic spelling as kalama, which means one of you makers out there needs to make a medieval-styled pen case with a squid motif. And speaking of making, if we can count creative writing as a form of making, even if it's not our usual sense of that word today, speaking of making, I picked calamar as our word in honor of this year's Medieval Death Trip Advent Calendar, currently hitting its midpoint over on Instagram. I'm doing something a bit different with it this year. I've designed it as a solo journaling game. A game used loosely here. Improv writing exercise is probably more accurate. Proper journaling games usually have more of a gamified element to them than this simple advent calendar, but it does nonetheless have some rules and constraints that I think justify calling it a game. The name of this game is Legende Sacrae de Capitibus Vel Caudis, or Holy Legends of the Heads or the Tails. In it, each day you flip a coin, or equivalent device, to pick either a heads prompt or a tails prompt, and write a short entry accordingly. All of these entries are constructing your own saint's life. In this case, specifically, the life of a saint that was born with either an animal head or an animal tail. You can get an overview of the game, how to play, and a little discussion of historical context at our website. The link specifically is medievaldeathtrip.com/LSCC2025, which is short for Legende Sacrae de Capitibus Vel Caudis, LSCC. To find the actual prompts, follow us on Instagram at MedievalDeathTrip, or you can search Instagram for the hashtag MDTAdvent25, which should pull up all the daily entries so far. There's plenty of time to catch up still and participate, or you can bookmark it to play in the new year. Also, if you don't want to engage with Instagram, understandably, then just wait. I'm intending to make the whole game available in a printable form on our website, again, in the new year. But that said, I think it's designed to work in the rather slight mode of an advent calendar, so I do think that's the optimal format to experience it in. Also, if you noticed that our advent calendar looks a little different this year, that is at least in part because I'm eschewing generative AI for these images, and for the text content, too, of the game. All the door images covering the daily prompts are real photos taken by me of real objects. Now, I use Photoshop to prep those photos and the manuscript images that accompany the prompts, so I can't 100% promise that there isn't some element of AI algorithmic processing going on in the background to some of the images, but I have not used AI to generate new images or text. Perhaps that's a bit of atonement for using Meta's Instagram for so much of my social media presence. I'm trying to muddle through somehow, as the song says. And on the subject of songs and complicity with companies that are increasingly sullying their own ethical reputations, I will also mention again that, for now, I've still got a Spotify playlist of medievalish and otherwise thematically fitting holiday tunes called MDT Christmas. I think it's a great playlist and highlights some good early music artists and is worth a listen if you haven't given up on Spotify. You should be able to find it by searching Spotify for MDT Christmas, two words, and there are also links to it in the sidebar on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. I'd like to thank our new and upgrading patrons on Patreon. A big hearty holiday thank you to Hudson, Adam, and Mudhooks for your support of the show. Anyone else interested in helping us out with as little as $1 a month on Patreon will get bonus audio content, including appendices to selected episodes and an audiobook of Friar Jordanus's Mirabilia Descripta, or Wonders of the East, translated and with commentary by Sir Henry Yule. You can do that at patreon.com/mdtpodcast. And lastly, in the gift-giving season, I always like to give a plug to the book which this podcast is the namesake of. I've learned I've technically been saying that wrong for years. Strictly speaking, a namesake is the thing named after something else, though common usage allows for the reverse. But to be dictionary correct, I should say that we are the namesake of Wisconsin Death Trip by Michael Lessey from 1973. Memorably described as, quote, probably the only doctoral thesis with a cult following, end quote, by the AV Club's Keith Phipps, this book is a collage of photographs and excerpts from primary sources in and around Black River Falls, Wisconsin, from the last decades of the 1800s, with a focus on the gruesome, the weird, the macabre, and the uncanny, and by putting all these things together, paints a portrait of the kinds of anxieties facing the rural Midwest just before the turn of the century. It's an amazing and captivating piece of work, and while we have no affiliation with Michael Lessey, I like to think that this show's efforts to showcase primary sources and put the medieval weird and gruesome into a larger context lives up to the spirit of Wisconsin Death Trip. Do I sometimes wish I'd given this show a name that wasn't derived from an existing work? Sure, but in the meantime, it's hard to think of a better work to be derivative of. So I encourage all you weird history lovers out there to pick up a copy of Wisconsin Death Trip for yourselves or similarly disposed friends. It is still very much in print and very much worth reading. So, happy holidays, and remember to not just leave cookies out for Santa, but also a bowl of sweet milk for your local kobold, and thanks for listening.